So we're going to begin today a new six-part series in the book of Ruth. This is really one of those short but epic love stories. It's filled with danger, it's filled with intrigue, it's filled with romance. But the main theme of the book of Ruth is what we call the providence of God. What is the providence of God? It's the teaching, the Bible teaching, that when God created his world, he did not leave it to chance, to luck, to fate, to just natural causes, but rather that when God created his world, he chose to govern it, to rule it, so that everything turns out according to the purposes of his will. So as you read the scriptures, you start discovering, for instance, that from the rising and the falling of nations to simple small things like the rolling of a dice, from the death of a sparrow to the exact day of your death, the scriptures all declare that God's hand governs and rules over all of these type of events. Now, sometimes it's very easy to see the hand of God, as when a miracle takes place in a biblical story. Clearly there is God's hand at work. But the vast majority of time, even in the Bible, and especially in our lives, we cannot discern. We do not know why the hand of God is doing what he is doing. This is why the providence of God has often been called the invisible hand of God. The book of Ruth is about the invisible hand of God in the lives of just really ordinary people. I like this. We're not talking about kings. You're not talking about emperors and such. Ordinary people like Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. Not only that, it shows the invisible hand of God at work in just ordinary everyday events. Things that they face and we face the exact things, same things today. Things like trying to find a job. Things like trying to find a marriage partner. Dealing with the death of a spouse, dealing with the death of a child, dealing with our sexuality, the pain of infertility, and relationships with one's in-laws. We see here in the book of Ruth that the invisible hand of God is governing and guiding and leading all things so that by the end of the book, we see God's hand has brought all these things to pass. God is ruling. It is the invisible, providential hand of God. Now, as soon as we begin to talk like this about God governing all things, his invisible hand working through all events, the first question that begins to come up on our minds is the question of trials and pain and suffering. On April 20th, 2001, Jim and Veronica Bowers took off in a Cessna airplane with their 7-year-old son, Corey, and their 6-month-old daughter named Charity. They were missionaries in the country of Peru, and they took off in the Cessna, and they were flying across Peru. A Peruvian fighter jet mistook them for a drug-running plane and was given orders to shoot them down. Bullets ripped through the Cessna airplane, and it shattered the pilot's knees, but with tremendous expertise, he was able to kind of land the plane down in a river. Jim Bowers was shaken, but he was okay. He turned around, though, to see that his son Corey was alive, but his beloved wife and his 6-month-old daughter had been killed by the same bullet. It's stories like this that raise questions in our minds about God's invisible hand at work? God governing all things? How does that work? I'm going to come back to their story later in the message, but this is the exact tone that Ruth begins on, the book of Ruth. Like any good story, the book of Ruth begins with pain, with suffering, with tension, and with questions. The book of Ruth in the first chapter, the theme of the first chapter is really God's hand in our suffering. And so why I want to do this series, really the whole book of Ruth is about this, how we work through suffering, how God's invisible hand is at work, and why I want to do this is to try by God's grace to accomplish what this book is trying to accomplish, namely to equip us, to strengthen us to deal with suffering. Some of us are in suffering right now. We need this kind of a book. Some of us have not experienced a lot of suffering in our life, and we're thinking, oh, well, maybe this doesn't quite pertain to me. But listen, if you don't feel like you've really experienced much suffering, you are very young. and you have not experienced much of life yet. We will all walk the road of suffering at some point. So I'm either wanting to equip you for the future if you're not there now. I want to strengthen you for the present, or maybe even just deal with some of your past and wounds that are still with you and questions that you have around the sovereignty, the providence of God, and these questions of suffering. And what I want to show you is that it's the truths of the book of Ruth that will sustain and comfort you when everything falls apart. So today we're going to begin in the first chapter. I want to develop three themes. First of all, the bitter providence of God. Second, the sweet providence of God. And then finally, we'll talk about our response. How do we respond to the bitter providence of God? So let's dig into this great story, this short but epic story, by beginning in talking about the bitter providence of God. Let's pick it up in verses 1 to 5. Look at the text with me. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, not Oprah. And the name of the other was Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman, that is Naomi, was left without her two sons and her husband. The main character of chapter 1 is not Ruth. The main character of chapter 1 is Naomi. You might even argue that she's the main character, actually, of the book. Naomi's name means sweet and pleasant. But right here in chapter 1, all that is sweet turns bitter. Right off the bat, we learn that she lived during dark days. We read that this story took place, what does it say in the first line? During the days of the judges. Now, if you know anything about your biblical history, if you've read the book of Judges, for instance, you know this was the darkest days in the history of Israel. It's summarized in that very last line of the book of Judges. And if you've read the last two chapters of Judges, you're thinking, wow, Hollywood's got nothing on what goes on here. It's the example of what happens when a society abandons God and everyone does what is right in their own eyes. So look at how Judges ends. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And then the book of Ruth picks up during these days. Not only that, we learn that Naomi lives in a time when there's a famine. Now look at it, the text, let's see how closely you were following. Where did Elimelech and Naomi live when they were first married? Bethlehem. You reading the same passage as me? Yeah, okay, it's right there. Verse 1, they lived in Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem means house of bread. But in one of the great ironies of the story, there is no bread in the house of bread. We meet this man named Elimelech. His name means, my God is king. But he doesn't really live like that. He takes matters into his own hands, and we read that he moves his family away from the land of God that God had given his people, away from the people of God, and to this country called Moab. God, in the Old Testament, did not want his people living in Moab, because the Moabites worshipped a god named Chemosh, who demanded child sacrifice. It was a terrible place to live. And yet, after moving to Moab, we read that Naomi's husband died. And again, a twist and irony, isn't it? Why did Elimelech move his family to Moab? To live. What happened to Elimelech when he got to Moab? He died. After moving to Moab, this all takes place, and so Naomi, poor Naomi, has lost the love of her life in the middle of her life. But all is not lost. As you continue on, you start reading, she has two sons. And she has two sons to love her, to care for her. They even get married. And so now there's hope that maybe her sons will provide grandchildren. The family line will not be destroyed. Maybe now things will turn around for Naomi. But in another bitter twist, we start to see that her two sons and their wives are unable to have children. There's infertility going on here. 10 years they can't have kids. And then the final blow is struck. Her two sons die. It's of course tragic when anyone dies, but as is so often said, a parent should never have to bury their child. Even worse, a parent should never have to bury both of their children. Naomi is left in a terrible state. Typically, a woman in this culture would return to her father's house, but likely she is now too old. Her parents have probably passed away. She is too old to have any more children. Her family stands on the brink of annihilation. Add to all of this that she lives in a foreign land among a people who despise her ethnicity and worship a false god. And so there is Naomi. Just imagine her standing there in front of the three graves of the only people who are her family, those whom she loves, her husband and her two sons. Who or what is responsible for this? Is this fate? Is it bad luck? Is she just living at the wrong place in the wrong time? Is it karma? Is it the devil? Is it just natural cause and effect? For the Christian, the really big question is, where is God in all of this? And if you're asking that question, the narrator of the book of Ruth has drawn you into the story. Well, let's look at how Naomi answers the question of who or what is behind this. Let's jump ahead in the story for a minute. As Naomi heads back to Bethlehem, she tells her two daughter-in-laws to go back to Moab. But then watch what she says in verse 13. Verse 13, halfway through it. "No, my daughters, it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of Yahweh," remember when you see Lord capitalized, that's the personal name of God, it's the covenant name God gave his people. It means the God who is with us and for us. This God, Yahweh, here translated as the Lord, his hand has gone out against me. Then, go down to a little few more verses, she gets back to Bethlehem, and the people there are greatly stirred, probably because she left with a husband and two sons, and she's come back with two Moabite foreign daughter-in-laws, no husband, no kids. Pick it up at verse 19. "So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem, and when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?' She said, 'Do not call me Naomi. Do not call me sweet and pleasant. Call me Mara,'" which means bitter, "'for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, but Yahweh has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when Yahweh has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" Who or what does Naomi say is ultimately behind all of this? Answer, Yahweh, God. His hand is behind it. She is a true Israelite. She does not believe in fate, in chance, in luck, in karma. No, she believes that every event ultimately is governed by the providential hand of God. Now, I turn it to you. You don't have to answer out loud. Do you agree with Naomi? Do you agree that God's hand is ultimately behind all events that happen? That's going to need some nuance, but do you agree? See, the vast majority of Christians I meet don't agree with that. But do you ever find this strange? Christians will always, when you get a new job, when you find a spouse and you get engaged, when you have a baby, when an unexpected financial windfall comes to you, Christians are very quick to shout, "God has done it. God's hand has been at work. Look at how his hand was at work and how he brought us that extra money. Isn't it amazing?" But when a Christian loses their job, when someone dies, when an unexpected illness comes, then Christians are often not quite sure how to answer that question. What happened here? Is this the devil? I met a Christian woman once, and I would dare say she expressed what many Christians probably think but have never said out loud. She said to me dogmatically and argued with me for a good long time that all the good things that come into our life are from God, and all the bad things are from the devil. But listen very carefully to me. That is dualism. Dualism is the belief that the universe is governed by yin and yang, by the, if you're into Star Wars, the light side and the dark side of the Force. It's that kind of thinking. If you're a Christian, it's there's God, and there's this equal but opposite power, the devil, and they're locked in a war for control. That's dualism. Equal but opposite forces warring with each other. But listen carefully, Christians are not dualists. Christians believe there is only one almighty power in the universe. Oh, the devil's a power, absolutely. But compared to God, he is but a pawn on God's chessboard. So this is then what we come down to. I'm going to say later on in the message, Naomi's embittered response needs help. She does. But her theology at rock bottom is correct. The Bible teaches that the universe is ruled by God, that all things, whether good or bad, ultimately come from the hand of God. Now, we could take a ton of time on this, but we already saw Naomi saying it. Here's two other texts that are really big, broad ones that encompass a lot of things that show this. Just track these with me. Lamentations 3:37 says this, "Who can speak and have it happen if Yahweh has not decreed it?" In other words, nothing can happen unless Yahweh has decreed it. "Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both calamities and good things come?" Well, that's not usually what we're taught, is it? Or how about 1 Samuel chapter 2? "Yahweh brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. Yahweh sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts." You see how all-encompassing that is? Now, I could quote 1,000 more texts. One thing I would encourage you to do, I did this once when I was struggling to think this through, read through the Old Testament, for instance, and just look at all the times it says that God, the Lord, Yahweh, does something. You'll see it everywhere when you start to look for it. It's Yahweh who raises up a nation. It's Yahweh who raises up a king. It's Yahweh who disposes a king. It's Yahweh who brings rain. It's Yahweh who brings a famine. His hand is absolutely everywhere. So this is I'm going to just end right here because our text today is clear. Those texts are clear where it simply says the Bible teaches that all things ultimately come from the hand of God. Now, I'm going to end the exposition there, but here now we got to deal with some big questions, don't we? Question number one that comes up as soon as we start to talk like this. Here's the first question. If everything comes from God, then aren't you saying that God is the one who makes evil happen? That God is the author of evil? Are you saying God is sitting up in heaven plotting our demise and plotting all the bad things that happen to us? No. The best story on this and understanding the answer to this question is the story of Job. You remember in the story, Satan comes to Job or to God one day, and he asks permission to strike down Job's family. God allows him to do this, but how does Job respond? We sang it this morning. Job responds by saying, "The Lord gives, but Satan took away." Right? He says, "The Lord gives, but it was Satan who took." When a preacher misquotes the Bible, there should be an uproar. You can't let preachers get away with that. Do you know what he said? He says, "The Lord gives, and who takes away?" The Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Wait a minute. Hold on, Job. Don't you know the story going on here? It was Satan who came to God, asked permission to do this, and it was Satan who accomplished this. Then why would you say the Lord gives and the Lord took away? Wouldn't you say Satan took away? No, no, no. He goes on. When Job's wife says to him, "Curse God and die," he tells his wife, "Shall we receive good from God and not trouble?" We learn something very important here. Although everything must pass through the hand of God, not everything originates from the hand of God. Although everything must pass through the hand of God, not everything originates with the hand of God. In other words, God is not just sitting up in heaven plotting a way to destroy Job's life. That's not what he's doing. Satan has to ask permission. God is not therefore the author of evil. He's not the one who thought up the plan to try and destroy Job's life. But here's the flip side. Although the idea did not originate with God, it had to pass through God's hand. There's only one God. There's only one throne in the universe. And even Satan, the most powerful being next to God, must submit to that. He can only do as God permits. So God, therefore, in that sense, that's why I say all things ultimately come from the hand of God. Because God has to decide whether they're going to happen or not. This is why Job and this is why Naomi say it was Yahweh who took away. So if you want to talk about God's providential hand, you got to uphold these things. First, the scriptures everywhere talk about it's God, in the words of Ephesians 1, who works out everything in conformity with his will. So you got to say that. Then you got to, right away, you got to uphold something else. But what, isn't God then the author of evil? No, you got to uphold this as well and say, no, God is not the author of evil. He is holy and he is good. But there's another thing that must be upheld, and that's the next question we have to ask. If God really ordains all events, doesn't that then destroy human freedom and destroy human moral responsibility? I mean, doesn't if God's ordaining what comes to pass, are we just robots? How can we be accountable? Here's the answer. The Bible teaches that God's providence does rule over all things, but it also teaches that God never coerces the human will, and therefore we are morally accountable. So you see, we're having to uphold a whole bunch of things. God causes whatever comes to pass to come to pass. He does it in a way that he's not the author of evil. And he does it in a way where he does not coerce the human will so that we are robots and we can't turn around and say, you know, something bad happened and we're not responsible. So you got to, it's like juggling, right? You got to hold all of these up. To let one of them fall is to miss a major part of the picture. Theologians use the word concurrence to describe this. Concurrence means to flow together. Think of it like currents in a river. There are many currents going down a river, but it's one river. The best story to really understand this is the story of Joseph, one of those great stories of the Bible in the book of Genesis. Now, let me ask you a question. Think before you answer. Who was it who sold Joseph into slavery in Egypt? Well, be careful. That's one of my setups. Who was it? Who ultimately sent Joseph to Egypt? Again, right away, if you know your story, you have to uphold a whole bunch of balls at once. You can't just say one answer. So here's some of the answers. Were his brothers responsible? Absolutely. His brothers are the one who took him out of the pit. They sold him to the slave traders. Were they coerced in their actions? Did God, like, manipulate them? No. They were free in their actions. They're morally responsible for their actions. The slave traders, they're the ones who actually took them down to Egypt. They're morally responsible for their actions, never coerced into what they're doing. And yet, Psalm 105 says, and I quote, God sent a man before them, Joseph sold as a slave. I thought his brothers did it. I thought the slave traders did it. No, it was God who sent Joseph. Joseph, throughout the story, many times ends up saying this. In Genesis 45, he says, and I quote to his brothers, "Now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here." In other words, you are morally responsible. But then right away he says, "For God sent me before you to preserve life." You see concurrence here? We have to uphold all these things that are going on. There are many currents. There's the currents of the brothers' actions, the currents of the slave traders' actions, the currents even of Joseph, and he's kind of a little bit of an idiot as a younger brother to kind of boast to his older brothers and provoke them, right? There's all kinds of currents going on here, but what this is saying is it's all within the river of providence. God is directing things, all these actions, so that everything goes exactly where he wants it to go. So put all that together. You've got to uphold those things when you want to have this kind of a discussion. Uphold, yes, God ordains what comes to pass, not in a way that he's the author of evil, and not in a way that coerces people and makes people no longer morally responsible, but all things ultimately come back to his invisible hand. Now, let's quickly apply this before we move on to the second point. This is huge comfort in times of suffering. You see, you can find comfort in the fact that, first of all, your life is not subject to impersonal forces like fate or chance. The stars do not control your life. That's very good news, because those things are impersonal forces you can't control. Moreover, your life is not subject just to chance and natural causes, because you can't control that either. But what you do have is a personal God who governs over all things. Find comfort in the fact that although the devil may rage, and he does rage, he is but a pawn on God's chessboard. Find comfort in the fact that there is one ruler over this universe. He is the personal God. He is the God who is interested in human history. He is the God who seeks out every single human being, and he will love all those who come to him as his own children. This is the God who rules. This is the God who sits on the throne. That is the bedrock for comfort in times of suffering, is that there is one God who rules. His name is Yahweh, and his son is Jesus Christ, who came to rescue us. That's comfort right away. But we have to go on to the second point. We've talked about the bitter providence of God, but now we're going to quickly, just going to kind of dip our toes into the sweet providence of God, because that's what happens later in this story. Because you see, it's a big step in spiritual maturity when you start to understand this biblical truth. When you learn with Naomi, when you learn with Job, when you learn with Joseph, that God's the one, his invisible hand is at work in guiding my life and our lives. But it's not enough. I've met lots of Christians who get this idea. They get the idea of providence, but it's a cold doctrine to them. And by itself, I would also argue, providence by itself is a cold doctrine. What it needs is to be paired with something else, because when we struggle, when we suffer, we need to know that the providential invisible hand that's guiding and controlling all things is a hand that's for us and not against us. What we need to learn is what Joseph learned. And here's the big point. What Joseph learned is that the sovereign God is also a good God. That's the key. The sovereign God is also a good God. Therefore, all of his providences, even the bitter-tasting ones, are designed ultimately for good purposes. This is the key, friends. The sovereign God's a good God, and so therefore, even when we cannot discern it, his purposes ultimately are designed for good. Naomi is going to learn that in the book of Ruth. There's a verse you could put over the entire book of Ruth, and it would be Romans 8:28. That God works out all things. God works all things together for the good of those who love him. God works not some things. God does not work some things for the good of those who love him. He works all things. But listen carefully. This verse gets misquoted a lot. What that's not saying, it's not saying that God works all things so that you think that they're good. Like, you know, you crash your car and it means that God's going to get you a nicer car. That's not what it doesn't say all things that happen to you are good. That's not what it's saying. It's saying providence can taste bitter, but God is going to work all these things out ultimately for the good of those who love him. And what is the good defined as? It's in the next verse. The good is defined as that you and I would become like Jesus Christ. That's the good. When we mistake what the good is, that's why we can't get it. Even here in Ruth chapter 1, the sweet providences of God begin to shine through. Even here, that bitter providence that Naomi is experiencing, Romans 8:28 is already at work right when we get to it's the whole thing, but post verse 6 especially, we begin to see how God is working out all things. Naomi cannot see it yet. Just like you and I cannot see it often when we are in it, but God is bringing the bitterness into sweetness. Let me just show you really quickly a few of the rays of sunshine that peek out from behind the dark clouds of providence. Notice that the narrator gives us hints of what is to come. Verse 6. Then Naomi arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that global warming had given the people food. That the rains finally, by chance, by natural causes, came to the city, and so then they started to have food. Here again is providence. Notice right here, the Lord, Yahweh, had visited his people and Yahweh had given them food. How does God give food? You mean literally the hand of God appeared and there was bread there? No, God, by his providential hand, does things like causes the rain to fall, causes the crops to grow. The scriptures are teaching. That's providence right there. So right away, we're seeing that already Yahweh's invisible hand is at work. He's going to work things around to bring Naomi back to the city of Bethlehem, and things are going to start to happen there. So right away, we see things are beginning to turn, but you only know that if you've read the whole story. God is leading Naomi and Ruth back to Bethlehem, where his good purposes will be worked out. There's another clue. Look at the very last verse in Ruth chapter 1. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem, here it is now, at the beginning of barley harvest. Now you think, what's so significant about that? Well, it's very significant. Everything in this story is based upon the fact that the invisible hand of God is at work, so that at the time of the harvest, events are going to go in motion, which are going to change not just Ruth and Naomi, but hear this, the entire history of the universe. Oh yeah, that's not overstating it. Sometimes preachers overstate things. I am not overstating things. That Naomi returns at the barley harvest is key to the history of the universe. Why do I say that? Because right here at the beginning, Ruth is going to go out into the field. She's going to start gleaning. She's going to meet a man named Boaz. He's a good guy. Some of you, we got some pregnant ladies in the church. I'm recommending Boaz as a name. If you got a son, good guy. Really good guy. Bo, we actually already have a Bo in the church, but we could use another one. She's going to meet Boaz. Boaz is going to marry her. They're going to have children. And so in the very first paragraph of this book, we have a family who's on the brink of annihilation. At the end, the last paragraph of this book, Ruth and the family is saved. In the first paragraph of this book, it's the dark days of the judges where there is no king. In the last paragraph of the book, Ruth, who struggled with infertility, is able to have children. They have children, and the great and mighty King David is born through the line of this Moabite woman. In the first paragraph of this book, we learn about a man from Bethlehem, Elimelech, who dies. In the last paragraph, we learn that from Ruth's line comes the mighty King David, and from the line of David, there is born a man in Bethlehem, Jesus, the Savior of the world, the King of the universe. The birth of Jesus depends upon Ruth and Naomi showing up at the time of the barley harvest. You see what I'm saying? That's why I say the history of the universe is involved here, because Ruth has to have children who have to have King David, who has to come down to eventually Jesus being born, who eventually then becomes the king over all. You see, it's all part of the plan. God is working out all things for good. And this was written, friends, for you. This was written for you and I when we are under the dark clouds of providence. We can see no light. This was written for us that we would not become bitter like Naomi, but like Joseph, we would learn to trust God when we cannot see any of his purposes. Naomi can see nothing at this point. When we can't see anything, we can say, oh, there is a God who is on his throne. There is a God who will work these things out, though I cannot see any of the things that he is doing. That's why this was written for you. Have you heard of Corrie Ten Boom? She wrote a very famous book. If you've not read it, everybody really should read this book. Easy read. It's called The Hiding Place. It's probably in our church library. The Hiding Place, a great book you should pick up, tells a story about her and her family and how they went into the concentration camps in World War II and all kinds of things go on. She obviously understood suffering. And in the concentration camps and afterwards, she would often tell people, here's how you need to think this through. You've got to imagine the history of the world like a giant tapestry. You know what a tapestry is? We don't really make those anymore, but you maybe see them in museums. It's woven with thread, and a huge picture comes up, maybe of a battle scene or of a king or something like that. She says, though, imagine a weaver weaving a tapestry, but you are on the opposite side. You are maybe sitting at the weaver's feet. So you are looking up, you're watching the thread and the needle come through every single time, and all you see on the bottom side of the tapestry is just threads, random threads, colors going every direction, sticking out, knots all over the place. Nothing makes sense to you from that side of the tapestry. But when the weaver is done, and he turns it over, and he shows you every thread was put there for a reason, and it creates that beautiful picture. And what Corrie ten Boom was saying to people was that God is weaving every thread, not just of human history, but of your life as well. Though our struggles often make no sense to us, the Bible assures us that God is working out his story, he is weaving his tapestry, and no one will be able to stop him from completing it. This is also what sustained Jim Bowers in his suffering. And I honestly, I've got books and books and stories of people who this is what kept them going. This is what kept them going is, I believe there's a sovereign God and a good God, though I cannot discern his purposes. This is what Jim Bowers said at the funeral of his wife and his daughter. Quote, most of all, I want to thank God. He's a sovereign God. I'm finding that out more now. Some of you might ask, why thank God? Could this really be God's plan for Ronnie, his wife, and Charity? God's plan for Corrie and me and our family? I'd like to tell you why I believe so. He then goes on in his funeral address to give 15 reasons why none of this could possibly be chance and why all of this is the invisible hand of God at work. He then concludes by saying, Ronnie and Charity were instantly killed by the same bullet. It didn't reach Kevin, who was right in front of Charity. It stayed in Charity. And listen to these words. He says, that was a sovereign bullet. These people who did that simply were used by God. Whether you want to believe it or not, I believe it. They were used by him, by God, to accomplish his purpose in this. Maybe similar to the Roman soldiers whom God used to put Christ on the cross. So that's the second thing that we learn from Ruth chapter 1. That although God's providences can taste deeply bitter to us, in the end, ultimately, he will turn them sweet. Now we need to apply this and wrap it up. Our final heading is our response to the bitter providence of God. Let's finish up the story and get introduced to Ruth. Let's pick it up at verse 7. There's such an emotional scene here. Verse 7, so she, that being Naomi, set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May Yahweh deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. Yahweh grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. So she wants them to get remarried. Go back home, get remarried. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? So in other words, don't wait for me to have kids and let them grow up. That's ridiculous. No, my daughters. For it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of Yahweh has gone out against me. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And then right here on the road, Ruth is converted from being a Moabite to worshiping Yahweh. But Ruth said to her, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May Yahweh do so to me, and more also, if anything, but death parts me from you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. In this first chapter, we see three responses to the bitter providence of God. See which one you relate with as I say them. First, we have Elimelech. His name means my God is king, but as we said, he doesn't live like this. He lives like his own king. When suffering comes, he takes control of his own life. He abandons God's land. He abandons God's people and tries to control things himself. Elimelech, then, is that person or those people who would say, I did believe in God at one time. I even maybe still believe in him. Maybe they even called themselves a Christian. But when trials, when suffering came their way, they pulled away from God, they abandoned Christ's people, the church, they left the church, they left really Christ, and they're living for themselves. They are their own king, and it's suffering and trials that drove them there. Second, we have Naomi. Naomi is the Christian who rightly understands God's providential rule over all events, but is embittered at God in suffering. So this person, like Naomi, as we're going to see in this story, has yet to learn that God is not just sovereign, but he's also good. And then third, we have Ruth. Ruth is the example of faith. This Moabite woman grew up not knowing who Yahweh was. She did not know of him, and the little that she does know, she learned from Naomi. She also has tasted the bitter providence of God. She's been in struggle with infertility. We've also seen she's lost her husband, and now she's having to care for her widowed mother-in-law. Two women destitute in a culture where two women in that kind of a state, it's a terrible state to be in. And yet right here on the road, she is converted. She literally says, your God, my God. Your people, my people. Ruth is the example of faith. She is the person who does not claim to understand the invisible God, the invisible hand of God, but trusts him in her pain. That's what the whole book of Job is about. What does faith look like in suffering? That is what Naomi is learning. What does faith look like when you cannot track the invisible hand of God? Why would God do this? Faith is saying, I have no idea, but I will trust him in my pain. As your pastor who loves you very much, I want to be able to equip you for suffering. I want to be able to strengthen you if you are suffering. And the first thing that you need, that we need if we're going to do this, is we need to get that life is not just controlled by chance, by luck, by karma, by the stars, by any of that kind of stuff. No, life is ultimately controlled by our Creator. But sovereignty by itself is not enough. We also need a high and a deep view of God's committed love for us. That's what carries you through. So how do you get that? How do you get deep in your soul that sovereignty of God in all things and that deep and committed love that God is with you and for you despite bitter providence? How do you get that? Well, you can look to the example of Ruth, look to the example of Joseph, of Job, but ultimately you need to look to the cross. For it is at the cross that we see the ultimate example of God's sovereignty and his goodness and love. See, the cross, first of all, shows that God is in absolute control of all events because the cross is the ultimate evil in the history of the universe. Think on that. It's the worst. Why? Because human beings murdered the holy and righteous Son of God. It's the most evil act in the history of the universe. But again, I would ask you, I'm going to word this carefully. Who put Jesus on the cross? Who put him there? Remember, concurrence. Did the soldiers put him on the cross? Yes, they did. They nailed him there. Did the Gentile rulers, Herod and Pontius Pilate, condemn him so that this happened? Yes, they were not coerced. They're morally responsible. Did the mob, the Jewish mob, did they call for his crucifixion? Are they morally responsible? Did they act freely? Yes, they did. These are all currents. And yet, friends, the scriptures everywhere say that Jesus was the lamb slain before the foundation of the world. It was all part of the plan. And Jesus in his life spoke that way. And all through the book of John, he's saying he set his face for his hour, the hour of his death. Luke is saying he was always on his way to Jerusalem. And then finally, two verses sum up this perfectly. Acts 2, verse 22, Peter is preaching and he says to the people of Jerusalem that this Jesus was delivered up according to the chance. No. Jesus was delivered up according to natural causes. No. Jesus was delivered up, you know, because bad people did bad things. No. Jesus was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. And then he flips it around to human responsibility and says, you crucified and killed him by the hands of lawless men. Acts 4, the exact same thing. In this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and peoples of Israel. There's all the human currents, but now listen, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. So how do you get this kind of deep, this sovereignty that can sustain you in suffering? You get it by going to the cross. For listen, here is the greatest act, evil act in the history of the universe, and yet here, God is on his throne. God is ruling. Nothing is happening by chance. It's not like when you know, they called out, crucify him, and Pilate washed his hands. All of a sudden, God was just kind of going, oh man, what am I going to do now? You know, like, plan B, ring the bells, angels, woo, we got to get down there. We got to help Jesus out. I don't know what happened. Everything's off the rails. That's not what happened. God is on his throne. God is ruling. How he does these things are a mystery to us. But if God, listen carefully, if God can rule the most evil act in history, can he not rule what goes on in your life? That's the sovereignty. And then what you need to pair with it is the goodness and the love. And how do you get that? Again, the cross. For if God would give up his own son for you, will he not, in Paul's words, graciously give you all things? When he says he will work out all things for your good to conform you to the image of his son, he is seeking your good in all these things. Do not become embittered against him. Jesus was forsaken by God so that you will never be forsaken by God. God did all this through Jesus. He did all of this for you and I. He did this for us because one day, if not in this life, but in the next, he will take all the bitterness and make it sweet. This is the message of Christianity, that he will renew all things, all that is broken, all that is lost. He will put back together. He will make the bitterness sweet. He is for us. His very name says it. You remember this from the Genesis series? His name is Yahweh, the God who is with us and for us. And Yahweh comes in the person of Jesus. And what does Jesus' name mean? He's not just the God who is with us and for us. Jesus' name means Yahweh saves. The God who is with us and for us has come to save us. So the cross, then, is the greatest proof of God's total sovereignty over all events, even the most evil, and it's the greatest proof of his deep and particular and committed love for you. So how will you respond to the bitter providences of God in your life? Will you turn away from God like Elimelech did when suffering comes? Will you become embittered like Naomi? Or, like Ruth, will you trust in the sovereign hand of God even when you cannot see what he's doing, trusting that he will make the bitterness sweet? Friends, you can trust like Ruth, like Joseph, like Job, because the message of Christianity is what we call good news. It is the good news that one day, perhaps in this life, most likely and for sure in the next, God will turn all that is bitter into that which is sweet. Let's pray.